Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a new study shows why the anti-war movement collapsed with the rise of Barack Obama. We'll get reaction from an organization that continues to resist Obama's wars. And can hip-hop artists be organized into a union of their own?
But first, former Georgia Congresswoman and Green Party presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney has made several trips to Libya, where the North American and European allies recently killed a son and three grandchildren of leader Muammar Gaddafi. McKinney says President Obama has taken the United States to new heights of criminality.
If there was anyone who doubted that our president was a war criminal, there is no doubt anymore. Our president has firmly put himself in the war criminal camp. Not only was that murder, it was cold-blooded murder, and it was the murder of three children who had absolutely nothing to do with the beef that the leaders of NATO have against the government of Libya.
And not a word of condolence from the black man in the White House.
Well, I think it's very clear that the black man in the White House is as bad or worse than any of the white men who have been in the White House. And that's why it's so important for people to not get swept up in the hysteria that is created around an election. I have said it too many times, but politics is not a beauty contest. It is not a popularity contest. It is not a horse race. Politics is about policy and power. And if we vote, or anyone cast their vote on the basis of those other things, oh, I like the way he dresses, oh, I like the way he looks, oh, I like the way she dresses, if that's the criterion that's used to judge whether or not one is going to cast a vote for this candidate or that candidate, or for this candidate or against the candidate, then one is just playing at the game of politics and playing it incorrectly.
And politics can be a life and death game. Colonel Gaddafi and his wife were at the residence when the bombs hit. It is against international law and against U.S. law to assassinate heads of state.
Absolutely, it is against the U.S. law, and it is against international law. That's why I say that our president has become a war criminal. And so now, what is the response of the American people to this unfortunate circumstance? There will be a whipping up of hysteria once again in 2012. In November, probably it will come to us in about September of 2012, the hysteria will begin to be whipped up by the Madison Avenue whiz kids. And the slick brochures will come out, and the American people will once again be corralled into voting either Democrat or Republican when neither of those political parties represents their true aspirations for peace and justice and respect for our planet. Neither of those parties. And so casting a vote for those political parties and candidates who are running on those political lines is going to be, once again, practicing the politics of self-abnegation, something that I think particularly black Americans and progressives in this country can ill afford.
United Nations Resolution 1973 didn't authorize NATO to assassinate Colonel Gaddafi.
Well, one could argue in the appropriate legal venue that the United Nations Security Council action was illegal and that everything that has flowed from that action has also been illegal. The sale of the oil constitutes a theft from the Libyan people. That could be argued in court. The seizing of the assets such that those assets cannot be used for the intended purpose, which was for the African Union, is also something that I have been told could be litigated in the international courts. And so it is time that legal action be launched to stop this. In addition, we just need to launch people action. And people action does not always mean marching in the streets. I'm not saying that we should no longer march in the streets. I do believe that there is a role for that. But that is not the only strategy that one should employ when we are confronted with this multiplicity of wrongs. Every wrong should be resisted in the most appropriate way of resistance. We are not doing that. And of course, the progressive community has basically found itself a bunker in which to hide so as to not be hit by a drone itself. But this president is being protected by certain leadership elements of the progressive community, and that is wrong, because at the end of the day, it's about principle, not personality.
So you don't see a dropping away of progressive support for this president?
I think when the time comes to whip up the frenzy, that we will see the same characters who were there whipping it up in 2008. They will be back despite their disappointments. Some of them have expressed those disappointments. They'll be back doing the same thing again.
And that applies to black politics as well?
Well, I haven't seen, other than Black is Back, you could probably name them on one hand, the blacks who dissent from the policies of this president. Those very policies that have enriched the rich and pauperized the already poor.
That was former Congresswoman and presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney.
Dr. Tony Monteiro is a longtime peace activist and professor of African American Studies at Temple University in Philadelphia. He talks about the significance of the NATO attack on Gaddafi, the head of state of a country that poses no threat to the United States or Europe.
I think it means that the Obama administration is committed to the military option as the first option in its dealings with governments, especially in North Africa and what is called the Middle East, that it has deemed its enemies. There is no negotiation. They are committed first and primarily and probably singly to the military option. The other thing is that this suggest a new level of the use of violence and state terrorism by the United States in its dealings with those governments that it has identified as its enemies. And, of course, this is not just Libya. This could include Syria. This could include Iran. Certainly the possibility of North Korea. So that. The other thing is that I think we're looking at a foreign policy that has a fascist quality to it. This behavior is reminiscent of the behavior of the Nazis in Germany in the 1930s and 1940s, that the only international law that they respected, and this is the case with the Obama administration, that it respects is the law that it establishes, which is the law of the jungle. There are no constraints at this point upon American imperialism and American militarism. And it is reminiscent of a type of fascist or Nazi foreign policy. The other side of this is that if this is the case in foreign policy, it cannot just occur in foreign policy. It has to bounce back into domestic policies. The chickens will come home to roost. So I think under our first black president, we're closer to a kind of fascism in this country than we have perhaps ever been. And it is not coming only from the Tea Party. It is coming also from the White House.
But there was this great expectation that under Obama we would not have the kind of blustering foreign policy, this bullying White House that we saw under George Bush. You seem to be saying, no, in fact, we've got an even more bellicose administration.
And I think a more sophisticated administration in terms of its uses of the media. And this whole thing of appearing to be deliberate is merely an appearance to win public opinion, at least in the short run, to their side. This administration is more adept at marketing and public relations than was the Bush administration, or for that matter, any administration that we've ever seen. So it wages a intense propaganda war at the same time that it wages a hot war. It does this thing of turning things on their head. It wages state terrorism in the name of defeating terrorism. But its state terrorism is the most violent, murderous, and dangerous terrorism the world has ever seen, perhaps the most dangerous since Hitler and the Nazis. And it acts outside of the bounds of international law, international organization, and is completely immoral. The targeting of a leader of a country and his family and his grandchildren, this is unbelievable.
The United States has full spectrum dominance. It can literally kill almost anyone at any time, if it chooses.
Yes, it does.
And now it seems quite willing to do so.
And this is the great danger. This is the great danger to humanity. World War II was preceded by smaller wars of occupation. Czechoslovakia, Austria, Poland, and then the attack upon the Soviet Union that actually begins the real Second World War. We seem to be in that same kind of situation here, and global war on several fronts we cannot rule out. For example, in the Middle East, it's obvious that the United States is acting in coordination with Israel. Israel lost two wars in recent years, two wars in South Lebanon. They were defeated by Hezbollah, the latest one in 2006. Israel's military doctrine is predicated upon a psychological advantage over its Arab enemies, meaning that Israel cannot be seen as weak and vulnerable to military defeat by Arab armies. So Israel has to settle accounts with the Arabs, and this means another war. Well, of course, the 2009 invasion of Gaza was a part of this, but it has to settle accounts in Lebanon. So we could see multiple wars in the Middle East, and of course, the Egyptian brokered unity agreement between Hamas and Fatah is seen by Israel as a threat, a military threat as well as a political threat. So here we have Israel that sees itself under attack because of Arab unity, of Palestinian unity, is preparing, I would think, to go to war. So another Middle East war, which is not just Israel against Arab states or Israel against Hezbollah or Israel against Hamas, but Israel and the United States at war with several Arab nations at the same time. Now, of course, as we move further into Asia and into South Asia, the whole quagmire in Afghanistan, which borders Iran and Pakistan, it is not an optimistic picture at this point. And the only thing that can ultimately stay the hand of American imperialism is a united global movement against the war making and war policies of American imperialism.
To some of us, it seems almost inevitable that the United States will move against the government of Pakistan.
I think you're right. That means that this whole idea that the United States will be out of Afghanistan by 2014 is a lie, because Afghanistan will be the rear base for military operations and military pressure and drone attacks upon Pakistan. Now, whether or not India will allow itself to be drawn in on the side of the United States is a question that awaits answer.
And, of course, Pakistan has a long relationship with its neighbor, China.
That's right, which represents another level and layer of this. And then, of course, you get into the regional alliance known as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which has as affiliated members Pakistan, India, and Iran. But then, you know, this Shanghai Cooperation Organization is built around Russia, China, and the former Central Asian republics of the former Soviet Union. But it has affiliated to it all these other Central Asian, South Asian nations. But then that gets us into the next level of the issue, and that is the consolidation of the East Asian economies around a currency that is not pegged to the dollar, maybe a basket of currencies, you know, the Shanghai dollar, the currency of Hong Kong, and the currency of South Korea, along with the renminbi, as a basket of currencies which become the exchange currency for all of these emerging markets. Thus, the marginalization of the dollar in this economic region, which is the fastest growing in the world. So here you have U.S. military provocation in a region of the world that is consolidating itself economically and consolidating its trade around a currency that is not connected to the U.S. dollar.
Can U.S. hegemony in the world survive if the dollar is not also hegemonic?
No, it cannot. The U.S. is able to carry out these military operations and maintain these 120 or so military bases all around the world because of the fact that the U.S. dollar is the global exchange currency. If the U.S. dollar is not that any longer, the U.S. military capacity is severely weakened.
Doesn't this create the temptation on the part of American planners who see this deep vulnerability with the collapsing of the dollar as the world currency? Could they not see it in their interest to move militarily before they collapse economically?
But if they move militarily, that further isolates them from the very nations and economies that they have to do business with. For example, GE, General Motors, Chrysler, Ford, Microsoft, Google, and we can go on and on, Goldman Sachs, Citibank, AIG, all of the major U.S. corporations have interest in the Chinese economy. War with China would damage or threaten their investment and interest in the emergence and development and growth of the Chinese economy. So a militarist policy towards China would not serve the interest of the largest banks and corporations in this country. Now, of course, all of these corporations rely upon a strong dollar, but a strong dollar, especially in Asia, is predicated upon the belief among Asian political and business leaders that the United States will act reliably and rationally. So an irrational military policy is a contradiction to the interest of U.S. business in Asia.
Nevertheless, such contradictions occur.
That's right, which suggests a very intense, the possibility of a very intense struggle within the U.S. ruling class. And it's so obvious that this is a struggle that took place in the early days of the Obama administration. And in the end, the militarist forces have won a partial victory. The big question is, can they advance a militarist and war agenda when it comes to China and East Asia?
A recent IMF report predicts that in 5 years, China will eclipse the United States in terms of its economic output.
The position of the dollar outside of the United States in the global economy is also a consequence of how leaders in other parts of the world see the political situation in this country. Can the politicians in the United States come to any agreement to solve the deep long-term problems, they see them as fiscal problems, of the U.S. economy? And I think people are very pessimistic about that right now. They see a country in political chaos rather than a country that is moving towards some kind of consensus. The other thing, you mentioned the psychological dimension. I think the psychological dimension, a pessimism, almost a nihilism, will be strongly apparent among ordinary working people, especially white people, who will be confronted with the idea that the United States, in fact, is not number one, not only in terms of total industrial production, but will no longer be number one in terms of the future development of the planet, that the world will be moving away from the United States, will be moving beyond the United States, and U.S. military strength will not be able to stop that movement.
The United States has been the number one economic power in the world since the 1890s. This would be a sea change.
And it would be a profound one. And the other thing is that it will be non-white nations, Asian nations in the first instance, but it will be based upon alliances of these nations that are not dependent upon upon the U.S., upon the U.S. economy, the U.S. dollar, or U.S. economic and political leadership. In fact, it appears that the United States is being increasingly excluded from these new and emerging alliances, such as the economic alliances in Asia, or, as I mentioned earlier, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And it's so interesting, while the United States is waging war in Afghanistan, economically, Afghanistan is moving closer to China, to India, to Russia, and economically and financially away from the United States, that its vast mineral resources, that is Afghanistan's vast mineral resources, are being invested in and developed by China and other Asian nations.
At Black Agenda Report, we call that the redlining of America. Is there a possibility that rather than go out in a bang, the United States may slip into a second-class status, a victim of redlining by people who no longer just want to do business with it?
People who no longer want to do business with the United States on U.S. terms alone. I don't think the Asian nations or nations in Africa or South America just want to isolate or redline the United States for the sake of redlining it. They're not reverse racists. What they want is for the United States that operates rationally and cooperatively and keeps its word and sticks to agreement and does not become a serial violator of international law. That's what the world wants. That the United States wants to act irrationally and as the world's only superpower, then they will be isolated. The world will move forward. But more than that, the world will move to the left. The United States can move to the right if it wishes to, but the world is not going to follow the United States. The big problem is that the U.S. ruling class and the U.S. political elite have few options in this new world but to cooperate or be isolated, and has very little moral or cultural capital in this game.
Dr. Tony Monteiro at Temple University in Philadelphia.
Two professors from the University of Michigan and Indiana recently released the results of a two-year study on the decline of the U.S. anti-war movement. Dr. Michael Henney and his colleague found that Democrats deserted the movement in large numbers as Barack Obama's presidential prospects increased. We asked Dr. Henney if he was surprised by the findings.
Well, I think that we were surprised, you know, when we began the research to see what would happen, because the study that you're referring to, really we started gathering the data in 2007, and we had no idea, you know, what was going to happen, who would be elected president, what would happen with the war, what would happen with the anti-war movement, and we decided that we would continue following the movement and seeing what happened. And so I would say that everything that's happened has been a surprise.
What was the principled reason for the tapering off and near collapse of anti-war activity?
Well, anti-war activity has really collapsed for a variety of different reasons. One of the reasons is just that the movement cycle has burnt out. People have become frustrated that the years of protest didn't pay off in terms of getting the government to change policies. But one of the findings that we have in the study is that a big part of the explanation for why things have tapered off has been that people who were identified with the Democratic Party in particular reduced their participation in activism. And that the reason why they did this, or one of the reasons why they did this, was because they no longer felt an acute sense of threat from the political system in a way that they did during the Bush years.
Explain that. What do you mean, felt an acute sense of threat?
Well, when we're thinking about why people participate in political mobilization, there are a variety of different reasons why they would do that. One reason is that they disagree with the policy. But there are a lot of policies that we disagree with that we might not engage in protest on. Coupled with that is a sense that not only is the policy one that we disagree with, but rather there's a feeling that normal political channels aren't sufficient to voice our grievances. And then also, not only are we sort of not able to voice our grievances and the policies are not the ones that we want, but rather the existing system is one that threatens us. So with a sense of threat and a feeling that we're not being listened to and that we disagree with the policies that are put forward, that is, these things combined help to mobilize people to participate in activism. So during the Bush years, part of the reason why so many people protested the war was they disagreed with the war, they didn't feel like they were being listened to by President Bush, and they felt threatened that not only was Bush doing this one thing that was problematic, but that there potentially were many things that he was doing or could do that would be a threat to them and their interests. As the Democrats came to achieve electoral success, people felt a little more listened to by the political system. They may have still disagreed with the policies that were put forward, but they no longer felt threatened. The people who were part of the anti-war movement didn't feel that Obama was threatening to peace in the way that President Bush was. So even though President Obama was continuing Bush's policies, perhaps the people in the movement or former members of the movement felt less threatened by someone who was simply continuing wars that already existed rather than someone who was starting new wars.
The wars have not just continued, they've multiplied. Why isn't the anti-war leaning public angry and feeling betrayed by him?
Well, there are a couple reasons for that. One reason is that the issue just went below people's radar, in a sense. People stopped paying attention to what was happening because there weren't new, in a sense, there weren't new declarations of war. So the war in Afghanistan expanded, but we were already in Afghanistan. So it's not something that people notice very acutely. Or we expanded the war inside Pakistan, but that was never really declared as a war. And then also the Libyan involvement is a relatively small engagement. So part of what has happened is that these new military engagements have been not as highly raised in the media as the original Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts were. And so as a result, there was less notice paid by people who generally don't follow politics all that closely.
Since Democrats pulled out of the movement when Barack Obama made them feel more comfortable, can we expect a renewed movement if the Republicans capture the White House?
Well, that's a good question. It would depend on what they did. I mean, I don't think that it would be as simple as if a Republican president were elected, would we expect to see in 2013 a renewed anti-war movement? I think if all that the president did was simply continue the existing policies, I don't think we would see large mobilization. But I think that if you saw major new conflicts, that you would be more likely to see new anti-war mobilization. I think in order to see a revitalization of the movement, you probably would need to see the emergence of major new conflicts.
Under a Republican?
Even under a Republican. The movement is, in a sense, demobilized. There would have to be something, there would have to be the offering of policies that made people feel acutely threatened. And, you know, you saw an example of that when President Obama went into the White House. The Tea Party movement was a group of people who felt very threatened by President Obama. And so you saw this kind of Tea Party mobilization. So I think that in order to see sort of a revitalization of the anti-war movement, you need to see a sort of new sense of threat emerge.
What you've been describing is a kind of mass sociology. But in fact, major anti-war organizations basically shut themselves down.
Right. Well, I think that has a lot to do with the resources that were available to them. You know, so part of what happened with, for example, United for Peace and Justice, is they just stopped getting contributions. You know, there wasn't really their support-based write-up. It isn't as simple as that they shut themselves down. It's more that the support in the political system for their activities really began to evaporate. Or was translated, the support that was going to their activities was translated into other efforts. We also have to take into account that when President Obama came into office, that a new agenda came in, too. So people, for example, some of the people who'd been opposing the war decided they'd put their energy into health care or into other kinds of political issues that had come onto the agenda with the Obama presidency.
Dr. Michael Henney at the University of Michigan.
When the anti-war umbrella group United for Peace and Justice withdrew from the scene, a new organization tried to fill the vacuum. It's called the United National Anti-War Committee, or UNAC. We asked UNAC spokesperson Joe Lombardo if it was his experience that some people only oppose Republican wars, but give Democratic war makers like President Obama a free pass.
I think there are some people like that. It's clear that groups like MoveOn.org will do whatever against Republicans, but will not protest against Democrats. I think the overwhelming majority of people in this country that are against the war are really against the war, but I think that most people in this country have no experience or no understanding of how social change takes place, and all they see is what they learn, is that you do it through the electoral process. So they saw the election of Obama as a victory in that sense and had a lot of hopes and perhaps illusions that he was going to de-escalate the war, and he didn't do that. So there was a demobilization that took place around that, and he did not do that. Now I think there's a demoralization that has taken place. And besides that, there's been so many other attacks that have been coming down against, the economic attacks, the foreclosures, the oil spills, the people losing their jobs, the attacks on unions. I think people are just totally numb and are demoralized and disillusioned right now. I think it's going to take a period of time for them to wake up. I think the anti-war sentiment was genuine, and I think in general, people are against wars. They have to be convinced about wars, and I think we're in another period right now with the killing of bin Laden, where they're trying to whip up the right-wing sentiment and trying to whip up this anti-war sentiment right now. But it takes convincing, because I think people are basically against the war. Our job in the anti-war movement is to turn that into independent action, independent of the political party, so that these kinds of demoralizations and demobilizations don't happen in the future.
Why wasn't there a feeling of betrayal and righteous anger at Obama?
I think it's happening. I think it's not in any major form, but I think a lot of people are abandoning the illusions about Obama, but just don't know what to do with it. There's not a huge visible anti-war movement. Part of that has to do with the problems with the leadership in the anti-war movement. They, too, were taken in by this, you know, Obama sentiment and demobilized. It's one of the reasons that UNAC came into existence. We saw that happening, and we saw kind of a default on some sections of the anti-war movement, and we decided that was not a good thing. So we came together. We tried to bring together all the forces that were still willing to protest, are still willing to get out there and oppose the wars, and we've been trying to keep an visible anti-war movement in the streets, but it's still a difficult time. I am hoping, and I think it will happen, that people will start getting really angry about what has been happening, and I'm afraid that what the powers to be in the government are stirring up for is an attack on the whole Arab Spring and what happened there. And I think that there will be some opportunities to really mobilize against that, and hopefully we can have larger mobilizations than we've seen.
People didn't just start drifting away from the anti-war movement. Elements of leadership actually shut it down.
Well, that's true. There are groups that have shut down. United for Peace and Justice closed up its office. It got rid of its staff. Had some financial problems, but that also probably is related to this demobilization that's taking place, and that's one of the reasons that they say they did this. But I do agree that the leadership in the anti-war movement did not play a good role in trying to keep an anti-war movement going, trying to help people understand that it was not just Bush's war that we were opposed to, or not just Bush, but we were opposed to the war, which is being waged now by the Democratic Party. So it's a war, it's a bipartisan war, and that's why we need to have an independent anti-war movement, independent of the political parties, and that's the only way to go forward in the future.
Will there be a significant anti-war candidate in the presidential contest, and does the movement need or want one?
Well, I don't think there'll be an anti-war candidate coming from the Democratic or Republican parties. There might be a third-party candidate. So the electoral process is not going to resolve the issue of war, because it will be a Democrat or Republican that is elected. But I think we could use the electoral process and political thinking that goes on then among a lot of people and to raise the issue of the war, and I think there might be some third-party candidates that might be willing to do that. But even there, I think it's important that the anti-war movement stay independent of any political candidate or political party, because there'll be people in all the parties who will be against the war, and we will have a bigger impact by being able to speak to all of them and being able to mobilize from people within any party or no party.
Joe Lombardo of the United National Anti-War Committee, speaking from Albany, New York.
The state of Louisiana is breaking the law when it comes to making it easier for people to register to vote. The NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund and Project Vote are suing Louisiana. Defense Fund lawyer Dale Ho explains.
Federal law requires, and it's a federal law called the National Voter Registration Act. It's more popularly referred to informally as the Motor Voter Law. And what that law requires is that all states provide voter registration services, not only at departments of motor vehicles, but also at all agencies that provide public assistance. So your agencies that provide Medicaid or food stamps or any other government benefit. At each of those agencies, state governments are required by federal law to offer voter registration services. And what we've seen in Louisiana is that many of these offices are not doing so. Many of the workers at these offices are unaware of these of their obligations. We know that the state of Louisiana didn't even have enough voter registration forms to hand out to public assistance aid recipients. So we know that they're not in compliance with federal law. And as a result, the number of people who have registered to vote of low income status in Louisiana has dropped tremendously over the last decade or so.
Motor voter, as they call it, has been law since 1995. Has compliance differed under Republican and Democratic administrations?
So in answer to your question, I don't want to make generalizations about the political parties, but what we do know is that in the mid-1990s, right after the law was implemented, we were seeing about 2 million people nationwide being registered to vote at public assistance agencies every year. Those numbers have plummeted dramatically. 10 years later, the numbers had dropped by about 80%. So in recent years, Louisiana is not alone. A lot of other states have been delinquent in their obligations to register voters in conformity with the motor voter law. And there's a lot of room for improvement.
People who apply for public assistance are disproportionately people of color, black folks.
Well, I'm not going to speculate as to what the state's precise motives are. What we do know is that this is an issue that is of tremendous importance to anyone who cares about the voting rights of low-income people and to people of color. We know that for a lot of people, your only opportunity to register to vote is when you have a chance to interact with the state. For a lot of people, that's at the motor vehicle agencies. But for people who don't drive or don't go to the motor vehicle agencies a lot, their one point of contact with the state is with the public assistance agency. So this is, for a lot of people, their only opportunity, really, to register to vote. So if you're concerned about the voting rights of African Americans in Louisiana, then this is an issue that is of tremendous importance. So, I mean, one of the most sort of common, you know, problems that we see is that maybe someone is in fact registered to vote, but they change address, they move, 6 months before an election, and they don't have an opportunity to update their voter registration information. So when they go to the polling site, they don't get a chance to vote. Well, if someone goes to change their address for their receipt of food stamps, then the state is supposed to allow that person, when they change their address for food stamps, to also change their address for voter registration purposes. It's a really, really easy thing to do, and the state's not doing it. So that's one thing that we would look for the state to do. The state should also be training its, employees about voter registration services that they're supposed to be providing. We conducted a number of surveys in Louisiana where people either called or went into, say, a food stamps office or a Medicaid office, and they said, while I'm here and while I'm applying for benefits, can I also register to vote? And they were told point blank by the state's own employees, no, you can't register to vote here. You have to go to the courthouse. Or, in some instances, well, we used to have some forms, but we don't have any right now. And I wouldn't even know where to get them or where you should send them to. So the state needs to do a much better job of training its own employees so that they're aware of what their federal legal obligations are.
That was Dale Ho, an attorney for the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund in New York.
Is there a future for collective bargaining in the world of hip-hop? Omawale Adewale is principal organizer for the Grassroots Artist Movement, or GAME. He's winding up a national campaign to organize artists and shine some light on the underside of the music business. It's called the Expose the Industry Tour. We asked Adewale what it is about the music industry that needs to be exposed.
We started the tour to really let people know what really happens in the music industry, specifically as it relates to hip-hop. So a lot of people look at hip-hop artists and they say, well, these artists are rich. They got a lot of money. So why do they need a hip-hop union? Because that's the goal of, the overall goal of the tour, is to create that awareness and a lot of noise to, to develop this movement. So we really have to expose, the issues and the problems that that artists are confronted with, you know, on a regular basis. There's a lot of artists that really, they'll finish their music. It'll take them maybe, you know, 6 months to, you know, do an album, and so we're waiting for it to get out, and then years, and it will never actually get out. And that whole time, the music industry or their label executives have been trying to get them to change some of their lyrics up to make them sound, you know, palatable. And when I say palatable, something that, you know, marketing execs, you know, deem to be, you know, sexy, you know, something that they feel, you know, they want more violence, basically, you know, when they tell artists, you know, you gotta get more hard, you know, they mean, you know, be more violent, you know, when they tell, you know, women, you know, be more sexy, you know, really talk about sex and do those things. So a lot of times those albums do not go out. They get completed on the label, but they don't get out there in the world. So you look at it from a perspective of anybody who does a particular job, works for an employer, you know, every day. You know, say the person is at McDonald's, and maybe they, you know, they get an epiphany and they say, you know what, I don't want to serve this, you know, to my community. You know, I don't want to serve this fast food junk, you know, every day. You don't need a degree to work at McDonald's, but you do need to get that money. So sometimes artists, you know, will give in and will say, you know what, all right, you know, he beat me down, you know, enough. You know, sometimes you don't need to beat some of the artists down. They already know what the game is. So they go in already, you know, trying to be extra hard, you know, something that they're not really in life or, you know, talking about sex. And so it's created in the music industry, and this is kind of like a big secret. If you're Eminem and you're a white artist, you can basically do whatever you want to. So he looks great. But I've heard great artists besides Eminem, you know, who are people of color, you know, black artists who get on and they sound great being themselves, but the music industry does not want them to, you know, to be themselves. They really have to change. And this is, you know, coming directly from artists, you know, a lot of the time. This has been for, you know, for a number of years. So this is what we want to expose, the truth of what really, you know, happens in the music industry.
So you're saying it is the industry, the A&R guys in the industry, that inject mm-hmm. such heavy doses of violence into hip-hop, not the artists necessarily.
Right. Well, it is ultimately, you know, the music industry is the A&R, it's the label, you know, who's making that decision to get this music out there. And sometimes those artists already know the game that they basically have to play, you know, they got to play it this way to get their stuff out. So sometimes they'll actually, you know, have no problem doing that, you know, because it's become a lifestyle. I use the example a lot, you know, with McDonald's, because they changed the whole fast food game up, you know, so much that pretty much most of the food that they, you know, they have are all GMOs, the lettuce, the tomatoes, everything, you know. So they made it for other fast food that everything is fake lettuce and fake tomatoes, they're all GMOs, you know. So so much that, you know, Monsanto, you know, the company that creates this, you know, the lettuce and the tomatoes, that they, you know, they pop. Artists coming in, they already see the games, like, this is what it is like. But if you take a snapshot and look at the 80s, they're talking about a lot of different issues. And not just talking about how bad they are and how, you know, cool. You look at the album now, you know, most of it is really, you know, kind of one-sided, no balance, and especially when you talk about, you know, listening to it on the radio or on the videos and watching the videos, you see basically something that is, you know, the same old, same old. So it's become one type of style, one type of, you know, image, you know, for, you know, all of, you know, black America as it relates to, you know, the hip-hop. Oh, okay, this is what it is. You know, I went to Nigeria and they basically look at it and say, oh, this is what hip-hop is, you know. And I'm like, no, that's really, you know, not what it is, you know what I mean? There's folks that are perpetuating that, you know, a lot. So artists already know, in order to get into the game, they have to have this particular style.
So how does your organization, the Grassroots Artist Movement, help artists resist the vulgarization of hip-hop?
We're developing a hip-hop union. So we're trying to unionize artists. We're fighting for collective bargaining rights, you know, for artists, so that artists can actually, you know, bring the employees to the table so we can discuss these things. They can be forced to come to the table and discuss money, discuss contracts, discuss benefits, discuss respect as it relates to, you know, letting ours, you know, be, you know, artists themselves, you know, letting them perform the way they would, or report the way they would, you know, want to, so they can be themselves, you know. So that's what we've been working on for, you know, for 10 years right now. And at this stage, you know, we're going, we're touring, we're back on, and we're going to hit every single, you know, state.
So the idea is if the artist is more financially secure, he or she is in a better position to not allow himself or herself to be exploited by the label.
Think of it this way. An artist can get $100,000 or maybe, you know, maybe $150,000. But how is that helpful? Or you need to get $200,000. That's not going to be too helpful if over 5 years the album doesn't come out. That's the only way they can get that money back. Unless they're doing shows. But in order to do shows, they need to have a sustained promotion. People have to actually know about them. So keep in mind, when you're doing this, all this money has to be recouped. You got two sets of money. You got one set of money that was given to you so that as a budget for you to record and do all the things that you needed to do. And then the other money was, you know, for you, like your money, you know, that your income, you know, that it was a source of income if you can tap into. You know, now all that money is pooled together. So every single thing has to be recouped. So if you got to do a video, you know, $200,000, well, that's not a lot of money these days, you know, for us to do a video. So you got to really do an independent kind of thing. And if the label was having meetings on your behalf, you better believe you're going to get a bill for all this stuff. So at the end of the day, you can be very broke and probably, you know, in the negative to pay this stuff back, especially if your album is not coming out for 5 years. And this is what happens. Artists, when you hear artists, you know, generally, you know, an overwhelming amount of artists, you know, you're on the label for, you know, the minimum of a year before anything gets out, you know. And I'm really selling short more than that. Smart artists would be like, what, a year? I wish I can get out in a year, you know. But they wouldn't be able to get. So you really got to, in order to say that certain artists are really independent, you know, let's look at Jay-Z. I mean, you look at these artists as, you know, they're financially well off, and they should have a lot of pull within the music industry. So you can look at Jay-Z and you can look at 50 Cent. Let's look at 50 Cent. You know, who really, you know, has enough money, really, you know, about, you know, $300-400 million. He still doesn't have that kind of weight. Look at it, you know, 50 Cent, he's under one label, Shady Records, Eminem's label, then he's under, which is under Dr. Dre's label, you know, then that's under Interscope, you know, and that's under Universal. So a lot of people who had to get that money. So unless he gets lucky, like he did with Vitamin Water, something like that, and he was marketed, and keep in mind, you know, this is somebody who has to get shot nine times. So if you're willing to get shot nine times, you know, you have a background, you know, if you sold drugs and you can sell that kind of story, you know what I mean? Well, then you too can, you know, be a multi-millionaire, you know, if you're willing to, you know, go through all of that. And even change his style up. Now, everybody knows that, you know, 50 Cent has changed his style up quite a bit. He says that in his record. A lot of people who did support him in that, you know, and you recognize he had to change. Same thing, you look at MC Hammer, also another multi-millionaire. He doesn't have those millions anymore. Has to be recouped. A lot of that stuff has to be recouped. He's also, I'm bringing up that he had to change his style. When he became afraid, he was a gangster, and then he was a pop artist. All three types of an artist, you know, but now is nothing to show for. So it's a huge gamble, and you really don't get power. You get some influence, but you really don't get power as an artist if you're willing to make if you're willing to say, you know what, I'll compromise and do that. You know, if that's gonna make you successful, we'll go ahead and you know do that. But that's for a tiny you know snippet percentage, you know, of artists who are going to even make that money to begin with. You know, especially the way the music industry is set up now. But I also want to say that one of the things that we do help artists with, you know, is some artists don't want to be on labels. They already know what the game is. You know, they don't want to be on labels, so they become independent. So we help those artists with every single facet. If they have to get recording, we get into a studio. We also started offering grants, you know, loans to folks who are serious about their projects. you know, so they need to get artwork, they need to get somebody, they need to get locations for shoot a video, performances, promotion. You know, we tap into our ground support, we tap into our resources, you know, that we've been developing over, you know, 10 years, and make sure that they can be independent. We're working on both sides of the angle.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my colleague Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Caitlin Fitzgerald.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.